So welcome, everyone. This is our fifth podcast of Getting Stuff Done in Higher Education. My name is Kevin Schreiner, and I am joined by our co-hosts, Fritz and Kelvin, which all of you have had an opportunity to hear and understand where they are in getting stuff done in higher ed and our journey here today. We are have the opportunity today to speak with Michael Edmondson, who is the Associate Provost for Continuing Learning at New Jersey Institute of Technology. And so we're going to hear a little bit about how Michael has been getting stuff done, not only in New Jersey, but in his higher education career. So welcome, Michael. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Kevin, Fritz, and Kelvin. Really, I'm honored to be the first official guest. I did listen to a few of the prior podcasts, and I just love the title. As soon as I saw it, I was like, yes, someone that's focused on getting stuff done. Let's do it.
Yeah, that's great. So, Michael, before we kind of jump into your work at New Jersey, why don't you share with our listeners how you got into higher ed, and really kind of, did higher ed choose you, or did you choose higher ed?
I like that.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I've always positioned myself as having a non-traditional career path, so I'll just explain it, and feel free to interrupt at any time. If you can't tell, there's an accent. Well, it's a Philadelphia accent. I grew up in Southwest Philly. Some people say they grew up in Philly, but they lived in the suburbs. And I'm like, no, I grew up in Southwest Philly and went to West Catholic High School for boys. And then I applied to one college. Now, this was, I'm probably the oldest person on this call. So this was 100 years ago. I applied to one college and I got into that one college, Cabrini College. And I was the first, I'm a first gen. Like, no one in my family had gone to college. And, my parents were so supportive of me at Cabrini. I mean, talk about a fish out of water. I had no idea like what college was, but I had good support system at high school. And they said, no, you have to go. I'm like, okay, I'll go.
Wow.
Yeah, I literally had no idea like what's college. Like, I don't know. I mean, like, if you don't have a family history of college, right? Like, what is it? I don't know, someplace you go and maybe learn. And
we could spend a whole hour plus just talking about this thing, which is
100%.
Interesting. So, but sorry.
No, it's okay. Please. I learned so much, so much. Anyway, Cabrini College is now closed, of course, because it's one of the many schools that you can do a whole hour on school closings. Don't get me started. But, so I met, we only have an hour. This takes, you'll learn quickly, just interrupt me because I could talk forever. I was not always this verbose. I mean, my God, when I was 18, I was scared to death of my own shadow. But I met a young woman in the library there back in, 40 years ago, 1986. I always tell the story that she was bothering me, but of course no one believes that if they know both of us. And we eventually got married and have two beautiful adult children now. And actually, I became a pop January 3rd of this year. So, it's been an amazing.
So, sorry, Michael. So, that's the other thing that Michael and I share in common. So,
that's right.
I'm also referred to as a pop from my first grandson. And so, it was interesting. We were both at a conference presenting, and he said he was a pop. I'm like, I'm also a pop.
That's right.
I'm actually expecting another grand.
Oh, congratulations.
We know it'll be a grandson.
Yeah, that's great.
It's going to be a pop in April again.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So I don't know anything about colleges. And so I had to fill out like a form. Everything was paper back then in the 80s. And they're like, pick a major. I'm like, well, I don't even know what's a major. I don't know. And more importantly, what are the ramifications of choosing a major? I have no idea. I chose accounting. It was the first one on the list. I don't know. So I took an accounting course. This is not me. And luckily I was also in a history course at the time and with this instructor, Professor Jolyon Pitt-Girard, and just fell in love with history, the way he taught it. He was a Vietnam vet, he had a PhD from Maryland, studied under Wayne Cole, this famous diplomatic historian. And I just fell in love with history. I'm like, okay, I'll change my major to history, not knowing what I was going to do at all. So fast forward, I graduate Cabrini, and I'm like, well, I don't want to work. So I went to Villanova for my master's degree and got a master's in history. And Jolyon was like, you've got to go and get your PhD. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, I'm a first gen from Southwest Philly. I'm not PhD worthy. And my good friend, Lowell Gustafson at Villanova, was the chair of the poli sci department. He was on my master's committee, still a good friend today. And he said, no, you really should go. I'm like, oh, I'm okay. So Lori and I had gotten married. And of course, everyone said it takes forever to have a child. Well, it didn't for us. So my first semester at Temple for the PhD, Amanda was born. So like I worked right after Villanova. I worked at I taught social studies from fifth through eighth grade at an elementary school in Camden, at like, you know, one of the poor cities in New Jersey. And so I learned a whole lot about teaching fifth through eighth grade in Camden. And it really was a humbling experience. And then I started the PhD program. Well, I taught for a few years at a high school, and then Jolyon hired me to teach history at Cabrini College. So I always credit those first few years of teaching K through 12 as like, I think every college professor should teach K through 12. Like that's when you really learn classroom management and you really learn what it means to teach, not just to be the sage on the stage and pontificate, right? So I felt it really helped me develop as a professional. So then I was like, okay, so I'm teaching, getting the PhD. My specialty was the 1920s U.S.-Mexican diplomatic relations. And I graduate with my PhD in history. It's like uber proud. Everyone is so proud. I can't believe it. My good friend, Peter Brahman, who also has a PhD in history from Temple, who's his military, mine's diplomatic, was working at a pharmaceutical marketing research firm that only hired PhDs in social sciences. And he's like, hey, we have a job. You should come and do this job. I'm like, I don't even know what you do. So I talked to my wife and she said, you're teaching, you're a good teacher, but you have a really good business mind. I think you should go for it. And I'm like, okay. So I applied and got the job. And here I am, I'm traveling the world, interviewing physicians and healthcare professionals about how they treat conditions. And I'm working with Fortune 100 pharmaceutical brand teams.
So I got a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So was this a deflection off the path you were going to go? I mean, were you like, I'm gonna apply for tenure track jobs. I'm doing it. Or is this, were you at the nearing the end of your PhD program? Like, oh crap, what do I do next?
Yeah. So I was at the end of the PhD program. I could have stayed at Cabrini, Fritz, but then I'm like, you know, I don't want to look back at the end of my life. Like I do. I've written a lot of books and do a lot of self-reflection, and I said, I don't ever want to look at the back of my life, at the back of when I'm at on my deathbed and look back and say, I wish I did. And so, like, I know the five regrets of the dying, like, and all the research is overwhelmingly clear what those five regrets are. So when I had the opportunity to leave teaching and go into this for-profit sector, I'm like, oh no, this is an inflection point in my life. I have to understand what this moment in time is, and I'm going to take it. Full so, well knowing, I don't know what the next steps are, right?
Yeah.
But I'm like, no, I trust myself. I just went through a PhD program. I have a PhD in history. I can pretty much, this is me talking to me now, as a first gen coming from lower, you know, middle class in Southwest Philly, growing up in a row home, I can pretty much do anything now. I have a PhD in history. Like, my God. Like, not that I'm unstoppable, but I feel really confident. And so I took it. It was a leap of faith in myself, not knowing like what, you know, where I would end up. And it was, I still look back very fondly on those years. And obviously I fell back into higher ed. That's part of this journey. But I always said, I don't need an MBA because I learned it on the street. I'm working with, you name a top tier pharmaceutical brand, I'm working with their brand team. I'm walking in and presenting to brands that are worth billions of dollars, little old me. I'm like, oh, I got this. So it gave me a sense of confidence that I don't think if I had stayed in higher ed ever would have.
Okay, this is interesting. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, if you would have stayed in higher ed, was your track to be, so you're teaching, were you teaching middle school when you were doing?
I did middle school for a year, high school, and then I was at Cabrini College teaching.
Okay, so you're an instructor at Cabrini.
So I'm an instructor. And they're like, hey, do you want to stick around?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know if I, the initial plan, right? When I'm in college at my undergraduate at Cabrini, and I'm talking to Jolyon and Jim Hetke, who's chair of the poli sci department there. And I'm like, well, I guess I could do what you did, like go the tenured route, right? And then eventually become the department chair and so forth. But see, that's all I knew, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's why I'm not a big fan of pathways. We could spend a whole hour just on pathways. Because I'm like, well, there's got to be more to life than just that one path. The problem is, how do you figure it out?
So it's interesting to me is that you went to college. You did your undergrad at, you graduated in the late 80s?
88, yeah.
Okay. And you were a history major?
Yep.
So you graduated in 88. You're 10 years older than me. I graduated in 98.
Okay. Thanks for that. So you were...
Happy 60th birthday coming up, by the way. Just kidding. But to me, you're graduating high school or graduating high school and I'm sorry, you're graduating college with a history degree at a time when a lot of people still got these more generalist degrees, history, English lit, you name it. It wasn't much of a pathway mindset to undergraduate degrees. Right. And then people often went off. And I know tons of people, you know, English lit majors who went off into marketing, all these things. They went in these different directions into the business and private sector world. They didn't just slot into the profession with the name associated with their degree, like history degree equals history path.
Right.
English lit means you're going to be a book editor or whatever. So you were graduating college at a time when that was still way more the norm than it is now. And at a time, you finished your doctorate in 99, it looks like.
Yep.
When, you know, adjunctification was just starting.
Yep.
But yep. I'm interested in the person. You said someone else who had a PhD who said, we only hire PhDs in social sciences and degrees. I'm interested in that person. I mean, not that we want to go down the rabbit hole, but and that company. Because that says to me, even in the late 90s, when, you know, you don't have a computer science degree, how are you going to work in the web world?
Right.
All this kind of stuff. So to me, it says a lot of good things about the company you worked for, the person who said, I see in you, because I feel like there's still very much this tension between those things of you need a data analytics degree versus you need to have that knowledge, but you need a whole corpus of expertise around that to then really do that well. So it's really interesting stuff. And sorry to.
No. Well, I had said, I don't know anything about pharmaceuticals. They're like, you have a skill set. That's what we want, is your advanced skill set. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, I can learn pharmaceuticals. And then I became like a semi-expert on how generics are made because I can read and analyze and tell a story. That's what historians do.
Yep.
So I was working with a PhD in economics, a PhD in psych, a PhD in soc. It was amazing. And so we traveled the world interviewing healthcare professionals, gathering data and telling a story to brand teams. Like, who knew that even existed? I didn't. No one in my family even understood what I did.
Yeah.
You know, which is okay. So long story short, so I do that for a few years. And then Peter and I actually started our own consulting company because we're like, well, we can do this. And we did. And we had, you know, several years of success. One of our clients was this nonprofit called the Philadelphia Center. And that used to be part of Hope College in Michigan. It was an amazing off-campus program. You know how you go to Spain or Rome or Tokyo to study for a semester? Well, there's several domestic programs, two in Chicago, two in DC, one in Philly, one in New York. And so this is the Philadelphia program, the Philadelphia Center. And they needed like someone to teach entrepreneurship. I'm like, well, I launched my company and, you know, I can help teach entrepreneurship. And so then they also said, well, we need help with enrollment because our enrollment's low. I'm like, okay, well, let's take a look. And I put a plan together and they're like, okay, great. Well, who's going to implement it? I'm like, I don't know. You paid me to put a plan together. And so they hired me to be their director of marketing. And then I actually wound up teaching a couple courses there. And that's when I started traveling the country, talking to presidents of liberal arts colleges and provost and professors about the value of experiential education. And I had 6-7 years outside of higher ed, right? I had a perspective that most people in higher ed never get because they stay in higher ed their whole lives. Nothing wrong with that. But it's like, I know what the world thinks of you because I've been out in that world and I can see things differently. And Donna Randall, who was former president of Albion College, put me in one of the leadership programs, I think the Council of Independent Colleges for Future College Leaders. And so I was like, oh yeah, this is cool. And long story short, stayed there 5 years, doubled enrollment, had a really good time. But after 5 years, there was nothing else for me to do. So I applied for the Associate Vice President of Career Development position at Augustana College in Illinois. And I'd asked my family, I think my daughter had graduated college, my son was still at college, and of course my wife. And they're like, just do what you want to do. Like, just do what you want to do. I'm like, okay. And I got the job. Who knew I'd get this job? So I'm out in the Midwest at Augustana College, hire a great team. And we create the, let's talk about getting stuff done. We actually, because what my admin, Lisa, came in one day into my office a couple of weeks into my time there. And she said, oh, you're really serious. We get stuff done. And I'm like, it's called work for a reason, Lisa. Let's go get stuff done. And we created, I say it's still the nation's, well, at that time, this is back in 14, 15, 16, the nation's first professional preparation tracking program for liberal arts students. So in other words, what we did real quick is if you were a freshman, you were, you know, try to get these five things done, you would get 10 points. If you were a sophomore, if you got these five things done, you'd get 20 points and so on and so forth.
So early badging?
What's that?
Like early badging? I mean,
basically, yes, early badging, for badging really designed with like career readiness in mind.
Yeah.
And I had IT create a little app. And so whenever you came into our career office, we would sit down and we would write a career RX, you know, like a prescription pad. We had career RX pads. And we said, okay, let's, you know, Fritz, you have a LinkedIn profile, you redid your resume, but the one thing you haven't done is you haven't done a job shadow. So we'd like you to set up a job shadow for you. You know, what's of interest to you? So that was pretty amazing. I was very proud of that team, like really proud of that team.
That's great stuff. I mean, this is, well, we might, does the name John Lawler ring a bell to you?
It does. Why do I know that name?
Yeah, I was just wondering if we had like we barely crossed paths. Lawler Group, hiring and marketing firm. They worked with Augustana back in the day. I worked with
them. Oh, okay, okay.
So I was, yeah. It seems like you overlapped. So I was wondering if there was like a
probably
6 degrees of separation without Kevin Bacon in it.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's right. That's right. Things have to get a little bit personal here because it's part of the story. So I'm there a year. You know, we do this launch. Other schools come and visit. They're like, "What are you doing with this Viking score? This is amazing." We got a lot of good press for it. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, well, this isn't hard. I mean, like the one thing outside of higher ed teaches you is like, you get stuff done every day or you don't exist. Like one of the problems with higher ed is there's no sense of urgency. We work in semesters. You know what? We meet twice a year, once in the fall, once in the spring. Well, you're not going to get anything done doing that. Anyway, side note. So in summer of 15, so 11 years ago, my God. Summer of 15, my dad passes away suddenly of stage 4 lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And 50 days later, my wife's mother passes away suddenly. So summer of 15 was just tragic. And my mom, you know, graduated high school, living by herself in South Jersey, was really struggling. And it's the only time I ever cried in a professional setting. I went into my provost, Perina Lawrence, super friend still to this day. And she looked at me. She goes, you gotta leave. You gotta leave and go take care of your mom. I'm like, I do. I didn't have a job. My one kid's in college. I'm in my mid-40s. Like, and I'm like, I've waited the proverbial, you know, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, whatever it was. You don't make a decision, right? After something traumatic happens, you wait a few months. And I've waited and waited, but mom needs me. What am I doing?
Another leap of faith.
Another leap of faith. And again, I said, all right, Michael, you're going to be on your deathbed. Are you going to be proud that you stayed at Augustana or proud that you took care of your mother when she needed you most? Easy. So half my friends were like, you're crazy. The other half were like, it's your mother. Go do what needs to be done. And so Scout's honor, I'm driving across, left Iowa, driving across to New Jersey. I didn't have a place to live. We sold our house. We had no place to live. We had nothing. and Mercer County College called because I was applying all over the place right away. Right? I'm like, oh my God, I got to get a job, you know. And I was like, okay, the universe is taking care of me. And I landed at Mercer County College, director of continuing studies. They kind of knew you're probably not going to be here forever. You were just an AVP at, you know, Augustana. I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, I'm here now. Let me like do some good. Let me get things done. And I was there for a year and a half. And, you know, increased enrollment, increased net profit. I was like, okay. But then the dean of professional education and lifelong learning opened up at New Jersey City University. And I applied and got that job. And I was like, okay, now after 2 years, I'm kind of back on track, whatever the heck that means. And launched the division there, launched the Center for Workforce and Community Development, getting things done. Great team. Good people just want to get things done, right? They really do in higher ed. You just have to want to make that commitment to get things done. And had a lot of support. But then 4 years after that, they collapsed financially and laid off a bunch of people. So I was in one of those rounds of layoffs. And again, the universe just, I think that, you know, the karma is not what we think of in the West. Because I also used to be a certified yoga instructor and I studied Sanskrit and a lot of terms that we use a lot. And my good friend, Joe Konopka, who's at Ocean County College, he hired me to teach for the year. And I landed where I'm at now, NJIT. So it's a very non-traditional way, but there's a lot of lessons, right, to unpack for people.
Yeah, let's unpack some more.
yeah, please ask away. Like, it's all good.
One thing I'm just kind of curious, Michael, is with having the PhD, like you could have, and I don't know what your decision making process was, right? Like in the jobs that you're looking for, maybe you were applying for faculty positions as well. And you
weren't, I didn't want faculty.
Whatever. But, yeah. But it seems like you made this decision at some point that you're going to stay in like this continuing ed workforce mm-hmm. development.
Right.
Like, how did you land to say, this is where I'm going to be? Cause I mean, like I look at my background, you know, admissions, marketing, recruitment, and then kind of evolved into the online space and strategic planning, institutional research. Like there's I have a lot of little buckets, right?
Sure.
But you kind of fell into a bucket of workforce development, continuing it. Was that because of your experience right after your PhD of doing that work with that external company? Or
it's a good question, Kevin. I think it stems from conversations I had in my 20s with Jolly and a Jim at Cabrini College saying, what do I do with this degree? And if I didn't have their guidance, right, and their support and their love and their kindness, I don't know where I would have been. And so when I was going through the master's and I found Lowell, and Lowell was just a super nice guy and so smart and supportive. I mean, my God, his expertise is on political philosophy and my head would hurt talking to him. But I would reflect and say, the larger conversation is around career readiness, career preparation, workforce development, right? And the world of professional education, right? Which just happens to fall into most schools and in the non-credit realm. And so I'm in my 20s thinking, there's got to be something there. Like, I don't know what there is yet. So I get my PhD. And I meet a lot of people during those days. I'm presenting at conferences. Then I'm working in the for-profit world. And I come across people. And I think one, maybe two, there's two. But I remember one distinctly. Only one person ever asked, oh, you have a PhD? What's your PhD in? And I'm like, oh, history. And they're, you know what? Then they're like, oh, well, mine's in blah. And I'm like, oh, you have a PhD too. And you're in this business. And they're like, yeah, because it's all skill-based, not, you know, knowledge-based. And so the more I did that, when by the time I got to the Philadelphia Center in 08, thereabouts, 09, and then each semester we've got 50, 60 students from around the nation. And if you just stop for a moment and see them as people and not students, they're hungry for help. They need guidance. They want guidance. They want you to have high expectations for them. And so I became like the resident person. Like, can you look at my resume? Can you help me prep for an interview? Can you, this thing is LinkedIn now. What do I do on LinkedIn? And I was like, my goodness, these people need help. I like this. This is what a college should do, is to help people, not just teach them, right? Not just educate them. And educate, right? The etymology of the word educate comes from the ancient Greeks, educare, right? To bring light into darkness. And we do that very well. We educate our students, but I don't think we prepare them well enough. And so that's what I fell into, if that makes any sense.
It does. It does. Mm-hmm. I want to, Kelvin's normally not so quiet, so I want to give him space here to, if he's got something on his mind, I got tons of stuff, but Kelvin, I'm passing the mic to you.
No, just observations, really, before we move forward. I mean, it's just great that you took a chance to go to college. I loved what you said about applying to one, because yeah. I thought I was the only person in the world
who did that. I did that, too.
Literally all of us won college.
One. That's it. One. And I knew by Christmas. I knew by Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. Same here.
Yeah.
No, so, and I love... I'd love for our listeners to just, I mean, I really appreciate you sharing with us and them as people listen to this podcast about also how the path or up path that we take doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? Like you
right.
were,
That's
you know,
right.
you're starting a family,
That's right?
Around the time that you were starting a PhD program, which
yep.
is,
yep.
to me is still pretty amazing. Like when I went, I mean, I'm about just a few years younger than you. And I just remember, you know, doing the PhD, master's PhD together, but I didn't have to worry about any of that. Like that was right. just, you know, I was barely having a girlfriend, let alone trying to, you know, marry. Now I got a kid.
Right.
So that was interesting too, because that
yeah.
that could be another episode in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah.
You also mentioned something, your connections indirectly or directly with Michigan. I'm a native. I grew up in Detroit.
Okay.
So yeah. I totally get what you were saying there. So either now or maybe before we, you know, before we wrap up today, I would love for you to share with us a little bit more about, like, just given all the things that were happening in your life, like what kept you grounded, focused? Because I'm sure there were a couple times there, especially given the fact that some of the schools that you worked for eventually went away. Like what kept you motivated to, you know, to keep going?
Yeah. Should I answer that now? I mean, I can. It's
absolutely
sure, yeah. yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah. It's a really great question. The thing about me is I love to achieve. I'm like, I just love to do. I can't cook, sing, or dance. You never want me to do any of those three things. But I just love getting stuff done. Like taking an idea and turning that into reality. And I know people think I'm a little bit crazy, and that's okay. I think I've earned that. But you know, you think of the giraffe, right? Or the elephant or the rhinoceros. Pick an animal. We have two dogs. They're smart. They learn. They communicate. They do a lot of things humans do. But they can't turn an abstract idea into reality. My God, that is like the greatest gift a human has. But it's so hard. It's so hard to get anything done because of the 1,001 reasons, right? And distractions.
Laundry. So, that's the joke in our house. Why aren't you achieving? Why aren't you achieving your goals? It's laundry. Laundry's a problem. No, it's not. It's not laundry. You're not focused. No, it's like I'm pretty sure it's laundry.
Yeah, yeah. We can find the excuses, right? But I just really admire people that have been able to overcome the odds. And if you take a look, again, the research is overwhelmingly clear on this. Overwhelmingly clear. Pick a famous person. Doesn't matter what field they're in. You pick a famous person. Put 10 of those together. 75% of them had a terrible childhood or had to overcome something traumatic in their life. In other words, they grew up building resilience. And so if you have that in your DNA, again, I like the phrase, you're unstoppable. It's actually uncomplicated. You're just able to get things done. And so I had to overcome 101 things like that we didn't even get into. And so getting stuff done is like, yeah, whatever. Like, it's not a big deal. Let's go.
But you work in higher ed, as all of us do.
Yes.
So here's a question for you. So what allows you to, and it's not like you're just starting to really, you have positionality now. You know, you're in a provost.
Right, right.
Are you an assistant or associate provost? Whatever.
Associate provost.
Okay. So now you have positionality. You know, if you have leadership buy-in above you and support, then you can push things. But
yes,
you've clearly been getting stuff done in higher ed for a very long time.
Yeah.
From grassrootsy and middle levels. How? What's your secret weapon, your philosophy, your method? Because, you know, at those levels, it's often hard to get things done or at least move the needle on things, initiatives, innovative right. things when you have wrapped in other layers that don't often move quickly to take advantage of those.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it all starts during the interview process. At this level, if you don't have vision, don't apply for the job. Like you have to have a vision. And if without a vision, during the interview process for Augustana and then at NJCU and then at NJIT, I presented a vision. It wasn't fully fleshed out. It wasn't by any means like perfect, but you have to be a visionary. And if they buy the vision, then your job is to implement the vision.
I think that's key though, because you were applying and going to organizations that bought into the vision, and then you were able to, you had room to run and
yes.
get done. You weren't working for, let's be honest, there are often leaders who just want compliance out of their
100%. No, 100%.
Leadership direct reports.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen it. I've lived it. I know Kelvin and Kevin and I have talked about this. You were able to navigate to organizations that didn't buy into that crap.
Well, I wouldn't see, and Fritz, this is such an important point to understand. When I would go on interviews and like demonstrate my vision, you know, I would measure the reaction.
Yeah.
And I would say, look, if you're not interested, I completely understand. I said, I can't take a job where I just come in the morning, turn the lights on, and then at night shut the lights off. That's not me. I want to come in. I'm either going to blow everything up and start over, or we're just going to build from scratch and we're going to make something out of nothing. If you don't want that, I completely understand.
Then you don't want me. Right.
And you don't, and I would say that like just like this in an interview, because what you see is what you get with me. And I would say, Fritz, I'm honestly, this isn't going to work. I'm going to come in and I'm going to build from scratch. And I get it if you don't want me to do that. So it's been nice talking to you, but the interview should end now.
I
and
love it,
always
man.
Catches everyone by surprise, because who the hell interviews like that at higher ed? And
I
so,
love this. You know, this is why I love. I love folks from Jersey and Philly, because my roots are all the South. I'm from Missouri, and I got deep roots in the South. So that's, I live in Minnesota now. That is not like that here. So
I love
the bluntness and the open, you know, like, hey man, this is gonna work. It's been great talking to you. Bye.
Well, at Augustana, I mean, I scared the heck out of most of them. And the students even said, like, one day to the provost, could you tell Dr. Edmondson to, like, not yell so much? And she just laughed, and she said, I'll talk to him. But I'm like, well, this is just me. I'm just being me. This is how we talk in Philly. Like, I don't
say, not yelling, I'm talking. Yes.
Yeah, I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't have an accent, and B, I'm that loud, you know? So it's very fun. It's very funny. But I understand like the cultural differences. So that's why when I would interview with people, and even with NJIT, I'm like, yeah, you guys don't have like anything in the non-credit space. Like, it's the only sector of the industry that's growing.
Yeah.
It's the only sector. I mean, it's nice that some schools have like their highest like undergraduate core classes this year. Yeah, but the market's not growing. The market hasn't grown since 2008. And will not grow.
Yeah, and the dirty secret that
is not growing.
What's your discount rate? Yeah, your headcount.
Yeah.
What's your discount rate?
Right, you're bringing in more people. Great. What's your net profit margin?
Right.
Like, you know, it's nice, but at the end of the day, like, okay. So I think what you have to do is be honest with, like, what type of person do you want to be? And what I learned in my late 30s, early 40s is, oh, you have this vision thing. Like, you do a lot of thinking. You have a vision. Like, when at the Philadelphia Center, here's my vision, you know, for this place at Augustana. By the way, what's missing in the marketplace is this tracking system for liberal arts students at a top-tier liberal arts school. Let's create it. Yes, it does help if the provost supports you. Absolutely. You figure that out during the interview, though. I haven't went on plenty of interviews. I'm like, oh, I can't work in this place. They're not interested in change. And that's okay. Like, I get it. You're not interested in change. But it's just not a good marriage then. It's fine.
So then you match with an organization that is a good fit, right?
Yes.
Over your career, you've matched with these organizations where it's a good fit. Then what are you doing that's getting stuff done? Like, what's that secret sauce?
So there's three things. One is you hopefully have been given some financial support to hire people. Like, that's got to be during the interview process too. It's like, hey, like, what's the level of support? And if it's not there, again, it's going to be hard to like do, even if it's a little bit, like, that's helpful. Number two is you have to then start to tell the story. Like, what's your story that you're selling? And number three, as painful as it may be, you got to get the faculty on your side. You know, you're not going to get all of them. You're never going to get all of them. You get a few early, you know, adopters, and then you leverage their relationships, and then that's how you build. If you go in thinking you got to win everybody over, forget it. Look, I've been laughed at. I've been ridiculed. I've been ignored. That's probably another aspect that we don't have time to get into, are the personal traits. You're going to have a thick skin. I've been laughed at to my face. And I was like, God, you are so, like, I'm saying to myself, like, Michael, because I can go all Philly. People know, like, Michael, please don't go all Philly on them, but I got to tell you what they said. I'm like, okay, I got it. And I just say, you know, I try to remind myself, Michael, this person, A, has probably never been outside of higher ed. B, doesn't even know people in another department across campus. And C, doesn't really factor into what you're trying to do. Let it go. Let it go. And they, like, you can laugh at me. It's fine. At the end of the day, I still get stuff done. And that's okay. I mean, I've been laughed at everywhere I've gone. I've also gotten a hell of a lot done everywhere I've gone. And, you know, Lisa, the admin, we're still friends on Facebook. We still talk. People at Mercer, people at NGSU, well, most of them have left. But, you know, I'm still friends with many of the people where we've gotten a lot of things done. And I always say, guys, it's called work for a reason. What are we doing? Are we serious about this or not? I just did a presentation. I'm doing a lot of talk about AI lately. I was at a school district. It was an AI conference for K-12 teachers and administrators in South Jersey. And it was at a high school. And so what they did very smartly is they had high school students like babysit each of the speakers because we're in the different classrooms and we don't know where we're going in the building or anything. And so I had a lovely young lady, I think she was a sophomore, babysitting me. And of course I have to draw her into the conversation. And I'm like, it's okay, don't worry about it. There's 50 people here. And so I said, well, do you use AI? She goes, oh yeah, I have a French tutor that's an AI. I'm like, that's amazing, that's fantastic. And your teacher like acknowledged, oh yeah, our teacher wanted us to use that. Oh, great. And so I go on this spiel for an hour about the future of AI and how it's changing for the good and bad, blah, blah, blah. And at the end, I go up to this young lady. Her name was Victoria. I said, so did I scare the hell out of you or not? She goes, actually, what you said makes a lot of sense. And I don't feel as scared about the future. I'm like, oh. And then I was like, okay, well, I have to reflect on that. And then I realized what I was doing, and I do it at so subconsciously now. If I'm in the front of, because I was at St. John's a couple of weeks ago, to 50 faculty. If I'm in front of faculty, anyone of any influence, I just subconsciously go to the point where, hey, everyone in front of me, you're responsible for helping these kids out. You're responsible. Because who else is going to do it? I said, your faculty members, your instructors, your administrators, our responsibility is to help them get ready for a future that they're going to have jobs that don't yet exist. using technologies that haven't been created to solve problems you haven't even identified. So go change your curriculum, update your curriculum, figure it out, because they need your help. And she, and that's what she was talking about, because you're like yelling at them to make sure they do a good job for us. And I'm like, oh yeah, I just do that now, like so nonchalantly, because I really do, as a first gen, I always go back, I'm a first gen. What am I doing? I have a PhD in history. I'm an associate provost at a top tier polytechnic. I better go help out people less fortunate than me. How dare me not to? We just won $1 million grant from the New Jersey Department of Labor. It's called a digital equity grant to help people, you know, get skilled, probably just have a high school diploma, if that, and to learn about the digital skills they need to land a job today and be successful. I'm like, yes, that's what we do. That's what we do. And we're doing more of it. And I just think if schools took that kind of approach, I think they'd be, they would position themselves better. I think there's too much hubris. I've seen way too much hubris, you know, among my colleagues everywhere I've gone. Not all. You know, but people understand that, you know, the student has to come first. The student experience has to be a priority. And all too often it's not. It's not.
Yeah. And I think you raised some good points. I think a lot of higher ed says that they always put the student first, right? That the student is at the middle of every interaction. The student is the reason why we're here, you know, those types of things. But I'm a little curious with the push on AI. And a push on skills. Mm-hmm. And just as you mentioned, I mean, you're at a top tier polytechnic institution, mm-hmm. where a lot of those degrees are in essence skill-based degrees. I mean, we don't really say that they are, but I mean, computer right. programming is a skill, right? You know, anything in that STEM type area is a skill. Do you think it's easier, since you've had conversations with individuals outside of NGIT, do you think it's easier for you to talk to faculty about the value of a skill or the value of workplace development or the value of these degrees are for employability versus conversations with folks that are outside of that world that aren't making the connection between skills and the degrees that they're teaching?
That's a really good question. So my division is called the Learning and Development Initiative, or LDI. And it's the professional education and non-credit division. I don't have a single four-credit course in my portfolio. So I present it, you know, to the faculty. And remember, it's an R1, right? So they're very focused on research. And rightly so. They're very smart, research-driven individuals. But they're very unfamiliar with the non-credit space. Like, in my mind, yes, there are skill-based degrees. They don't see them... I mean, I can't speak for everybody. That would be completely unfair. They see it as more research, right, and theory-based, whereas the LDI, the Learning and Development Initiative, like, we have a new workforce readiness model that we've created, and it's been recognized as innovative. And it was in EDUCAL's the Horizon Report. I don't know if any of you are familiar with EDUCAL's Horizon Report. So we were included in the most recent Horizon Report as an innovative, like, pedagogical model. And your six skill domains, 3 tech, 3 humanistic, AI literacy, data literacy, digital literacy on the tech side, agile thinking, change navigation, and resource optimization on the humanistic side. So we truly are, right? We have 9-degree credentials. You get a digital badge, a verifiable credential. So we're all about the skills and knowledge, but on the 4-credit side, it's about the degree, right? Students have on the 4, they're on the 4-credit side. Learners are on the non-credit side. And so what we've done is, like, we're starting to plug this tremendous hole, you know, in the marketplace for a skills-based non-credit offering. It just didn't exist. Like, there should be thousands and thousands and thousands of people enrolled in our non-credit program. You know, we're just starting, you know, we're 16, 17, 18 months into it, and we're off to a very good start. And it's very interesting. Like, some faculty are like, oh yeah, I get this. Can you help me with this? Can you help me with that? And they're starting to see that even the structure of a non-credit course, right, is wildly different than a traditional 3-credit course. right? Mm-hmm. It's 45 hours of seat time. You've got 90 hours of homework. There's, you know, you've got all the accreditation standards to worry about. Non-credit side, we've created our own standards. As long as we meet those standards, which are best practices, then we're good to go. You know, I'm trying to get us to a point where every 12 weeks, we're creating a new non-credit course. That seems like, I tell people that and their heads pop off. They're like, what do you mean every 12 weeks you get a new course? Well, why can't we? We have this model. Last year, we did 18 courses. We're trying to do 24 this year. I'm pushing the envelope. Pushing the envelope. Let's go. World's changing so quickly. No one can keep up with it. I'm not saying we're going to keep up with it, but we're going to have the latest curriculum. You know, maybe it's a 20-hour course or a 200-hour course to help someone who just wants to be upskilled. They don't want a degree, right? Like, you've got a bachelor's, master's, or whatever the case is. You don't want to go back for a master's degree. You just want a verifiable credential from NJIT. Here you go. AI literacy, 200 hours. You're good to go.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting, so just the stuff that we've done at Nebraska in our non-credit space, and I don't know if Fritz or Kellen have seen this in their worlds, but I have more folks taking our non-credits that already have advanced degrees.
Yes.
Than
yes.
I have individuals taking that don't have any education.
Right. Right.
Like, I have people with a master's and a PhD coming back to take data analytics because they need that to upskill in their own work versus someone who's never gone to college or whatever going, oh yeah, my first course, I just have this desire to learn data analytics.
Yeah.
That was going to be one of my questions to you, Michael, was it sounds like things that people with post-secondary degrees want and need, you know, not yes. just certainly there's a need for people who have high school diplomas to tack these things on. But so, yeah, that's not my part of what the university does. I don't work in our college of continuing professional studies. I work with them a lot, but
right.
I imagine it would resonate what you both are saying would resonate with them.
Yeah. I've often said, I mean, you know, all the talk about there aren't enough people going to college these days and so forth. I've often said there's no shortage of learners. There's just a shortage of people that want to go to college and get a degree. People want to learn. You give them a product that's attractive to them, oh, they'll take it. They'll enroll in it. But if you make it like thousands of dollars and, you know, so much friction, like, they don't have time. They're caring for children. They're caring for elderly parents, you know. My goodness. Like, help the people out. It's not about you. It's about them. And at higher ed, it's like the mirror has been broken. It's like all we do is, oh, it's all about us. How can I benefit? No. It's how do we benefit the society at large, right? I think that's, God, we just have lost sight of that sometimes. Sorry, I can go off these deep ends and go down these trails, and I don't want to derail the podcast, so you keep asking questions.
I'm with you.
I appreciate your candor.
Yeah, go ahead, Kelvin.
No, I was just going to say we really appreciate your candor, and it's just, it's just a reminder. I like what you said, too, though. It still kind of comes down to telling the story, making the argument as well, because, you know, faculty are busy mm-hmm. and they are hired for particular reasons, maybe not for their teaching ability, but because they bring in research dollars.
Right, that's right.
You do have to be kind of like a translator, mm-hmm. part translator, part lawyer, debater. Yep. Like, you have to really kind of like show it that there's something in it for them in addition to the greater good, which is, you know, when they work with you, there can be a greater good to the learners that will benefit from these courses that you're developing.
Yeah, to your point, when I presented to all the faculty chairs, one came up at the end and said, you know, I had no idea your market even existed. I'm like, no, it's okay. I mean, and why would you? Like, you're in your field doing good research, and it makes perfect sense.
Well, because they probably thought, oh, this is, you know, this was always the domain of community colleges. Or,
right, like, right.
Grade schools or whatever. I mean, it was, the segmentation was more solidified and more obvious, maybe is the right word, back in the day.
Yeah. But I just think there's so much potential for, you know, colleges to help out at the general level. which is what we're finding out now. I don't know. I just, maybe the subtitle of the podcast is, it's not just getting things done in higher ed. It's getting things done in higher ed that matter, right? And have influence and an impact on people's lives. And I'm a first gen that I lived, I wasn't away from my parents ever for 18 years. I didn't have any money to go to camps and, like, you know, do that stuff that other kids had opportunities to do. So I ran cross country at Cabrini. And so that kept me wildly busy, which is wonderful. And Cabrini had a policy back in 88. For 6 weeks, you couldn't see your parents. Don't go home. Wow. And I was like, okay, well, I'm busy anyway, so I don't have time to see anybody anyway. And so I remember that was heartbreaking for my parents. And when I saw them after 6 weeks, I was like, oh my God, like, I can't believe, like, I made it 6 weeks, you know, without, because back then, right, no cell phone, no internet, like, you know, it's a whole new world. And I look back at that very fondly, saying, I'm glad they put that in place. Like, I learned how to be resilient. Yeah. Oh, by the way, fast forward, I did want to just come full circle here and finish, because, you know, I don't want to leave the podcast without saying what happened. So when I got the job at Mercer and found a place, my wife and I found a place. And then I guess, well, right away, Mom and I would spend every Saturday together and we would do our thing and take her out shopping and stuff. And then eventually a few years later, because that was like 15, 16, when I come back, 16 around there. So we did that for a few years. And I told Dad, you know, that I would take care of Mom, and my sister did a lot as well. And then COVID hit. I took care of Mom during COVID. And then eventually, like, she started. She passed 3 years ago. And I was there every step of the way with my sister. And I'm like, I have no regrets.
Yep.
No regrets. No regrets. You know, would I have still been in Augustana? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. But I don't really understand the word regret. I do a whole thing on this. I could speak for an hour just on this one word. But I don't regret because I really like who I am today. I think regrets are for people that don't like who they are or struggle with their identity. But I don't regret anything. All the mistakes. First of all, you don't learn anything from success. You learn everything from failure. So all the hard times, all the friction, all the difficulties, you know, having a baby, my first semester at Temple and, you know, working, just trying to make some bills. Like, that was ridiculous. Yeah, but I made it.
Yep.
You make it.
So
I still teach today. Yeah. I teach effective communication. It used to be oral presentation and they changed it.
So one of my questions, Michael, is, yeah. I mean, I wish we had more time. We always need more time.
I can always come back after the
100th. Yeah, do a revisit. Well, there's so many interesting, I have a million questions now, but one of them is, so we're in a time right now where college students, baccalaureate students of any age, I'm not going to just say 18 to 24 year olds,
terrified
about the job market, finding a job. People in graduate school, same way. It's not, you know, doesn't mean it's easier for them just because they're getting graduate degrees.
That's right.
What is your message to them? Because you finished college at a different time. 1988 was a different economy, the technological, everything. That world doesn't exist anymore in most ways.
Yeah.
For better, for worse.
Right.
Same thing with the late 90s when you finished your doctorate.
Yep.
So what is your message to learners now in any setting that you were part of, a non-credit otherwise, where they're like, well, how do I do what this guy did?
Right.
It seems like he just kind of fell into things, which is not the case. You worked your ass off.
I didn't have any help getting any job. Let me tell you, man. Like
pulling. It's all we talked about this before in our get to know you sessions. We each pull these strings that were very like spider webs.
Right.
You were talking about it too. Like, I saw this space that I could do something outside of a faculty and history role.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you find those strings and how do you make the leap of faith when there's so many things right now that are saying, get a linear path, get that that job-oriented bachelor's degree, accounting to accounting, data analytics, whatever. And now AI is throwing all that out of whack because it's going to take our jobs and all this stuff.
Yeah, so yeah.
What's your message?
It's a great question. I just gave my students this lecture the other night. and I've been saying this for decades now. If someone ever asks you, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? You are to give them the following answer. I do not know. Did you know when you were at 18 what you want to do with the rest of your life? And 99% of the people, if they're honest, will say no. And I said, if they give you a hard time, have them call me. I've yelled at plenty of parents. And I am so tired of, I'm a parent. We raised two children. They got through college. They do not have to have the rest of their life figured out.
I tell my daughter this all the time.
All you got to do is figure out your next step. That's it. Just figure out your next step. That's it. And I told my students, and they were so appreciative of the honesty, right? I said, the rates of depression among your age group, highest ever. Rates of anxiety, stress, loneliness. I said, you know where that comes from? People my age. I said, and that's our fault. And we're not helping you. We're doing a disservice to you by telling you if you go to college and go to the right college, study the right major, and you get your dream job. I'm like, I don't understand. You just have one dream and that's it? I said, you should have as many dreams as you need two lifetimes to achieve. That way you're never bored. I said, stop it with this nonsense of having to figure out the rest of your life. You're going to have a job. You don't even know it. My job didn't even exist years ago.
Same here.
You don't even have it. Yep. How the hell are you going to know what you're going to have? Yep. Focus in on your next step. That's it. Focus on your next step. Stay committed to developing yourself every which way. And just take a leap of faith, man. Take a leap of faith. I've done it. It's scary.
Mm-hmm.
I had no job in my mid-40s, but my mom needed me. Okay. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. A lot of people wouldn't do it. And I get it. You know, the industry has been pretty much the same since the Middle Ages. We just have been. The industry doesn't like change. And we could spend hours just on that alone. But I am telling you, there's enough movers and shakers. You guys are three of them. There's enough, right? There's pockets. There's pockets of people that get stuff done. They do it quietly or me loudly. You know, they make some progress. You know, they're trying to put a dent in the universe. They're out there. But my goodness, the last thing you ever want to do is tell a young person or an older person, don't matter, that they have to have it all figured out. No one has it figured out. No one ever has it figured out. You know, just stop. Just stop lying to them. Stop lying to them.
Yeah, it's a great point, because again, it reminds us, and maybe we'll close on this, but it reminds us that we are evolving, we are changing, right? As well as, to some extent, higher ed is, even though it's slow, there are, you know, opportunities for change that you do have to just be mindful of as well. So great points.
Yeah. And I think you ended it really well there, Michael, in that last part. And so
thank you.
We thank you. We appreciate that you took the time to.
Oh, thank you. This has been great. Hopefully you liked it and you'll air it. I don't know.
No, it was great. We appreciate you sharing personal things as well as your journey in higher ed. I think that's where all of us need to be. We all have the personal things that have kept us in or kept us out of the things that we're doing. And that is who we are. On a day-to-day basis. And so that impacts what we do, both inside and outside of higher ed. And so I think it's important for people to hear that. And so we appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today, learning about what you've done and how you are getting stuff done in higher ed. And we look forward to seeing more of what you're doing and accomplishing at NJIT or wherever your career takes you.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I really appreciate the time. Thanks for having me.